Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. Harry Truman didn't know the gun was loaded. That's what he says. He thought Winston Churchill was going to talk about the weather or something, so he took him down to Fulton, Missouri, and sat with him on the platform all during his speech, which was right polite of him. How was he to guess that one of the founding fathers of the United Nations was going to open up on the United Nations organization? Now we're told that the ex-vice president didn't know what the ex-prime minister was going to say, and in London, Mr. Bevan is claiming he didn't know about it either. By the way, Bevan's in for a rough time tomorrow morning. A terrific row is brewing inside his own party, and Labour MPs are going to stand up in the House of Commons Monday and ask him a number of very embarrassing questions. An excellent source wires me a rumor from London that it was Churchill who persuaded Attlee to appoint Bevan, and a Labourite was heard to say this week that Bevan stands with one foot in the Crimean Conference and the other in Crimean War. Everybody says they don't want war, and everybody's behaving as though they don't want peace. More of that in just a minute.
If you should ask an aviator what the name Lear, L-E-A-R, means to him, he would immediately say, radio. Well, that's because Lear, for 16 years, has put all its radio skill into the manufacture of radios for aircraft. And it's easy to realize what kind of radios these have to be. Keen, dependable, and right up to the very last minute. Before long, you'll be able to have a Lear radio for your home. For Lear is now building home radios, putting into them all the ingenuity and skill that for 16 years made Lear radios famous with flyers and earned the reputation that Lear is the name men fly by. Here are some of the features you'll find in Lear home radios. Television, worldwide shortwave, FM, remote control tuning, which lets you select your stations from your easy chair. Lear home radios will also have something that radios have never had before. Tape recording. I'll tell you more about this later on. Now back to Orson Welles.
The international pot is boiling over on the question of Soviet troops in the north of China and the north of Iran. There is an argument that says Russia is just looking out for itself according to the current standards of international morality, that you must blame the current standards for the unpleasant fact that the Soviet Union, by not pulling out of Iran on schedule, has for the first time broken a treaty. Moscow says Russian troops will be out of North China not a day later than American troops, and officials of our own government returned from North China recently have stated off the record that only 12,000 Marines are repatriating Japanese soldiers, which is all we're supposed to do. What about the other 38,000 American soldiers and Marines now in China? What are they doing? Where are they going? Says Jimmy Burns, changing the subject, quote, "No power has a right to help itself to alleged enemy properties in liberated or ex-satellite countries before settlement has been agreed upon by the Allies," unquote. And if you can't read the words Manchuria and loot between those lines, you need glasses. Says Russia, "The anti-Russian demonstrations by the Chinese are a frame-up." Says China, says you. Whatever the facts, our press has certainly given much more space to these parades than to the bigger, better news of military accord achieved last week after 18 years of virtual civil war between the government armies of Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese communists. They've agreed to a gradual but real merger, and if the world behaves itself, that means peace. If the world behaves itself, what does that mean? Yes, Mr. Stalin, it means keeping our word and living by the laws we make. No, Mr. Churchill, it does not mean saving the British Empire by going to war with the Soviet Union. Of course, there's an argument, too, that says it's all Russia's fault. Russia has this mad fear of encirclement, this crazy notion that the Western democracies are ganging up on her. So Winnie comes right out and says, by all means, let's gang up on Russia. By Friday, his companion on the Missouri jaunt had managed to indicate a little statesmanlike embarrassment. Certainly, Mr. Truman did not become the President of the United States to preside over the liquidation of the United Nations. This is a funny world, and this has been a funny week. Old Tory Churchill still seems to be directing foreign policy for the Labour government that pushed him out of power, and Herbert Hoover, who, like Churchill, was repudiated by the voters of his own country, the same old Hoover of the apple stands, has been called upon to feed Europe. Question. Mr. Welles, what's wrong with Churchill and Hoover? Hoover's supposed to have done a good job on food after the last war, and as for Churchill, what he did for Britain during this war is a matter of record. Answer. There's nothing wrong with Mr. Hoover or Mr. Churchill that a good election didn't cure. During the Battle of Britain, Churchill was a very, very great man. Just now I wish he'd paint more pictures and make less speeches. And as to Mr. Hoover, well, he's not outstandingly popular in his own country, and as a symbol of that country, he won't be welcomed in Europe. After World War I, Mr. Hoover, led the fight to feed Germany, denouncing France and other nations for wanting to get food first. This time, I hope you'll put Germany where she belongs, at the end of the line. What food is available should go by moral right to Hitler's victims, not to the people who made Hitler possible. If anybody must starve, let it be those who brought starvation to Europe. America, you know, is the only considerable landmass to remain exempt from the direct ravages of the world's most frightful war, and is also the only important agricultural area to enjoy a good harvest this year. We escaped the blight as well as the blitz. We have neither ruined cities nor ruined crops. We produced 1,123,000,000 bushels of wheat last year. It was a record. Question. How much wheat can we use normally at home? Answer. A little over 700 million bushels annually. Question. How much is sought for European relief? Answer. 200 million bushels for the next 6 months. Question. What does that leave? Answer. It leaves a comfortable margin of 213 million bushels for sale to the people who could buy it. We're told that millions of tons of wheat are disappearing because of a boxcar shortage. We're told that farmers are withholding grain because they're in doubt about future price ceilings. They're grievous charges, if true, but they don't alter the fact that millions of people in Europe are starving to death. Our government can't pretend to be surprised. The Office of War Information said 5.5 months ago today, quote, imports of food, variously estimated at from 10 million to 12 million tons, will be required in the next year to augment supplies in the liberated countries. Unless food is imported, the outlook for the coming winter is one of appalling hunger, unquote. Our government issued that statement at the same moment that many classes of food here were being released from the ration lists. Now there's a crisis. I've been asking government people why nothing was done in advance. Why, they say? Because everything here in Washington is being done on a day-to-day basis, from the top to the bottom, and that problem wasn't labeled today. Last year, the agricultural subsidies were so arranged, the price ratio of hogs to corn, that it paid a farmer more to feed his grain to cattle than to sell it for human consumption. This was the result of a loud and politically potent urging by the meat and cattlemen's lobbies. By December, Mr. Clinton D. Anderson, who's our Secretary of Agriculture, had started in to worry about wheat. Mr. Anderson was saying privately that even if the allocations for Europe could be met, and this seemed most unlikely because of insufficient transportation, it still wouldn't be enough for Europe's basic needs. September, November, the days dwindled down to a precious few. By the first week of February, President Truman offered a 9-point food program based on voluntary rationing. Now, President Wilson, after the last war, also called for voluntary rationing, and under Herbert Hoover, because Congress wouldn't make it compulsory politics. That was then as now. It seems this is an election year. It seems we can't expect the congressmen to ask the voters to get along without anything so important as French pastry in the interests of anything so unimportant as the French people. The tragic truth is that even if voluntary rationing is a total success, if we cut down on all the bread, wheat products, and fats and oils, the saving will just barely keep Europe alive on a minimum of less than 2,000 calories a day. The weak and old and very young may not even be able to survive at all on this diet. It just isn't enough fuel to fire up the human furnace to get the human machinery going productively. A shattered people cannot rebuild a shattered world on 2,000 calories. Of course, our American sacrifices will be excruciating. Our bread may not be gray or black or brown, but it will be an almost perceptible off-white. And just think of it, we're going to have to get along in the same amount of beer we used in 1941. And the chairman of the Famine Emergency Committee is Mr. Herbert Hoover. Question, what's his job? Answer, to appeal dramatically to the imagination of the American people. Mr. Hoover departs in a few days for a month's tour of the continent to personally view the starvation everybody knows is there. Officials admit this won't result in any new knowledge, merely publicity. Question, why should we feed Europe? Answer, because Europe is hungry, and hunger is a cause of war, and we want peace. Food will do more to build the peace than a meeting in London or the Bronx. And if we're afraid of Soviet expansion and the growing prestige of communism on the continent, food will do more to check it than a speech in Missouri. Now, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
Now, let me tell you a little about the Lear tape recorder, which will be a part of Lear home radios. With a snap of a switch, you can record anything you like. An entire radio program right off the air. The voices of friends, the cute songs and sayings of children. And as soon as you've made the recording, you can play it right back. Not even a delay for rewinding. And anything you don't want, you can whisk away simply by recording something else in its place. With all these features, tape recording, FM, television, remote tuning control, and shortwave, you might think a Lear must be an expensive radio. But actually, a Lear radio phonograph console combination with every one of these features included will cost you only about $500. And a particularly attractive chairside console with fine radio and automatic record player will be about $125. Down at the end of the list, you can get a handsome, capable table model for $19.95. So keep your eye out for the new home radios by Lear. L-E-A-R. Your dealer will have them soon. Now back to Orson Welles, whose views and opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent those of Lear Incorporated.
Dear Mr. Welles, you said for folks to write you a letter that you thought you could use them. What do you want me to write about? I can write about myself. After all, individual humans are the most interesting things in the world, and marriage is an interesting subject. So I'll tell you about mine and what I'm doing today. I live high on a mountaintop in a tiny three-room house. Today I'm rubbing out a batch of dirty clothes in the tiny combination living, eating, and sleeping room. We sure are crowded in here. Outside it's raining and gray and trying to freeze. My two babies are 2 and 3 years old. They feel pretty cross as the monkey heater keeps the room too hot sometimes while an icy draft steals across the floor. Hence, all our noses are running. My back hurts awful as I'm going to have me a new baby before long. It's in my way as I bend over the homemade tub and as I rub out the slick black garage work clothes my man wears. The whole situation gnaws on my heavily loaded nerves and I cry and sometimes scream angrily at my babies and my 9-year-old stepson. But not at my man. He is quiet and good, and he worships us all. But upon my shoulders is another tragic burden, whiskey. He fights it. He hates it. He works all week, and on the weekends his poor nerves crave it, so he takes some, which makes our Saturdays and Sundays a bleak, unhappy thing. He sent off after a treatment, but it never come. You reckon why? He loves the radio, usually wants one besides his bed where he'll play it night or day. If I get one, it'll be his alone. We hope to have a white cottage someday, new. He's a good carpenter, and I bought 3 acres of land before I married 4 years ago, paying for it at $4 a month. I was keeping house for folks at $3 a week, and it took me one whole year to pay for it. I was an old maid, so I guess that's why having babies hurts me so. I'm too old, but they are precious. Before I married, I tried every way to find a child to keep for my own, but they would not let me because I was not married, nor had no home to keep a child in. My hungry, plump arms would have been sufficient. But I hope I won't have another baby after this one. I hope this one's a girl, as my 2 stepdaughters both run away. One to marry a strange soldier, the other to live with her dead mama's folks down in South Georgia. Mr. Welles, you ought to see my valley where we aim on building our cottage. It's Dogwood Valley, at a tiny county seat in Green Hills, 19 miles from Chattanooga on a concrete highway. Cherokee roses and wild primroses cover it in the beautiful spring. 30 miles from here. Here we pay $8 a month rent. God wills we'll go back and live in Dogwood Valley. Happy. But my man must have the dark veil lifted from his life before we do. How long? Only God knows, if ever. Meanwhile, I'm an exile from home, and my heart aches so. Sincerely. Ladies and gentlemen, to the lady who wrote me this letter, who lives on Signal Mount, Tennessee, goes 5-tube Lear radio, without comment, with our sincerest good wishes. Now my time's up. Thanks for letting me come to call. Let me join you next week at the same time. Till then, speaking for my sponsors, the makers of Lear radio, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.